The Guardian.
Support for this podcast comes from Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes creating a professional website for your business, personal brand, or portfolio so easy, it's newsworthy. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.
Hello, I'm Alex Kratosky, and welcome to this week's special edition of Tech Weekly from The Guardian. The ability to be anonymous on the web is becoming increasingly rare. Rather than be a place where you can be anyone from anywhere, like the early internet pioneers celebrated, the gnomic, or the named web, is rapidly becoming the norm. Online services from Facebook to Google to the Guardian news site and e-commerce portals take tiny bits of information about you, what you do, who you say you are, who your friends say you are, and use that to build a uniquely identifiable profile that tells them exactly who you are when you're on the web. But this goes beyond connecting your online activity with an IP address or even a pseudonym that you've created. Increasingly, these little pieces of who you are online are tied into who you are offline, your real name, your real networks, your real location. What do we lose when our online activities are tied to our offline selves? And how anonymous can we really be online? The first interview is with Christopher Poole. Chris started the online forum 4chan in 2003, and the service is unique to most modern online communities because the users are totally anonymous, and absolutely nothing is saved on the 4chan servers. 4chan is a raucous and an incredibly lively service with over 20 million hits, and a notorious spin-off of activist hackers who call themselves Anonymous. I spoke with Chris, who goes by the name of Moot when online, about what it feels like to be classified by most people as the anti-Zuckerberg.
I think that the reason we haven't really, I don't know, come to appreciate that much, I think it's like just your average person has this fear of lack of identity. I mean, like Mark has gone out and said that, and Sheryl Sandberg and, you know, everybody at that company has kind of made the statement that identity is authenticity. And essentially, like, you are who you are online, who you are offline, and so you have this one identity, and to have multiple identities is kind of lacking in integrity, which I think is, again, like, just completely nuts. But I think most people, like your average person, would kind of buy that argument for, you know, like, well, if you don't have anything to hide. I mean, actually, Eric Schmidt went kind of so far as to say this with Google. He was like, it's really like, you shouldn't care about your search queries and what we do with them, because if you have, like, basically don't do anything bad, or if you have nothing to hide, then, like, Google, you know, like, Google won't know. And it's like, well, what? Like, fuck you. So, like, you know, he has this, like, one very specific way of, like, how he thinks people should use the web. Actually, I think that's what kind of terrifies me the most about something like, you know, Facebook kind of setting the bar as far as, like, what we kind of expect as users, is that, I mean, they do set kind of the expectation that users have in terms of, like, what kind of control they have over their identity and privacy online. And, you know, they've been kind of moving that bar slowly but surely, you know, in you know, what they would call probably towards transparency, but what anybody else would call, you know, lack of choice and lack of privacy.
It's interesting, isn't it, that we have these systems that help us to navigate the web, that help us to identify what's useful and not useful, things like Facebook, things like Google. They help us to navigate this sea of information. But they have very specific ideas about identity, about relationship, about what's valuable and what's relevant. And I'm wondering your thoughts on how their constructions of identity and their constructions of relevance and value is different from your own and what you've tried to promote.
I guess, I mean, like, so that, you know, for them, you know, their network is based, I mean, the more information they have, the better, right? And, you know, they can make a pretty compelling argument for, I mean, the way Facebook works is, in order to connect you with the right people, in order to show you a news feed that's interesting, is, you know, they need lots of information to figure out, you know, who you're friends with, who you're talking to, what you care about, what you click, what you like, what you comment on. And so they do, you know, need lots of data to tailor, you know, the product to you, which I guess they would probably argue is, like, their biggest value. I mean, that's something that they can do that nobody else can.
Additionally, they're making money, and
right.
4chan, as far as I know, isn't.
Right. So that all boils down to too. Then they're able to target ads, you know, against that, very kind of personalized newsfeed, and you know, make lots of money. And 4chan is the total opposite, right? Like 4chan is anonymous in that you don't register an account. Nothing's tailored to you. It's ephemeral in that there's no archive. So, you know, Facebook will probably store every message you've ever sent for the next, you know, 100 years. But 4chan, you know, things roll off the site within minutes, hours, in a few cases some days, but generally within a few hours. And it's kind of increasing. I mean, like a site like that is, I mean, a site that does either of those things is kind of becoming increasingly rare, you know, deletes, you know, content or doesn't require registration. And ones that actually do both of those simultaneously are, none are really springing to mind besides 4chan.
Why have you dug your heels in instead of creating some opportunity to make some cash out of this?
I think part of it is, like, I've always approached it as, like, first of all, like, in terms of my interest in it, is it's a hobby. I mean, I found it when I was 15. It kind of, you know, it was just kind of a magnificent accident in that it, you know, it was never intended to become a large thing full of people. And it was seeded to just maybe 20 people in the chat room. And you know, over the course of the past 8.5 years, it became 20 million people. And so I still don't think of it, you know, I've never been really employed by it. It's never employed anybody. It's really always been just me and a few handful of volunteers. And so I don't treat it like a business, because to me, it's not a business. You know, I treat it like a hobby, and it's always been this kind of labor of a love, kind of in my spare time kind of a project. And I feel like, I mean, just as long as it breaks even and I'm not losing money on it, like, I'm thrilled and will continue to keep it up for as long as I can.
But it becomes a bastion of ideology. You know, you have become an individual who stands for the anonymized web. And obviously that wasn't predicted. So how do you respond to that?
Well, I mean, that's definitely something that when I was 15, I definitely, like, 4chan was not, I mean, I knew a little bit about kind of Japanese web culture, not a ton. And so when the site was put up, it definitely was not about, well, let's create this alternative space for interacting without identities, blah, blah, blah. Like, there wasn't like an, like, ideological, kind of, you know, there, it wasn't like a founded for any purpose other than to, like, oh, like, this is a cool place for people to hang out.
But now?
So now, I mean, I guess I've kind of, as, you know, I mean, 4chan was founded in 2003. Facebook wasn't founded until 2004. So I feel like, you know, I've kind of, you know, I've obviously, like, grown up as an individual. You know, I'm 24 now. And I think, you know, as the web has kind of, you know, I've grown up with the web, and the web has changed, you know, pretty considerably in the past 8 to 9 years. You know, I kind of, not say I was forced into it, but I feel like I kind of, like, naturally grew into this position of, well, wait a minute, you know, 4chan kind of stands for, kind of stands opposite Facebook in a number of different ways. And it kind of, like, naturally just ended up as the person that kind of stood opposite, you know, like, of the kind of ideologies that Mark Zuckerberg has.
But of course, how does that feel? 'Cause, you know, you go to Facebook and you stand up at TED and you do Web 2.0 summits and you talk about identity and you talk about anonymity. So how does it feel to be that individual?
I actually really don't like being referred to as, like, the anti-Facebook or anti-Zuckerberg, because I don't think it's accurate, or it doesn't represent, like, the way things truly are. I mean, like, I'm really somebody who just cherishes having options. And so, like, I mean, I have a Facebook account. I use Facebook. I see plenty of reasons why people would want to use Facebook. And I don't envision a web that is fully anonymous. So, like, I think that's just as insane and crazy as a web that's fully identified. I mean, what I've only ever really argued for are choices, right? Like, options. I mean, the ability to choose how you want to known, you know, on the web. And I do think there is a real fundamental difference between something like, you know, Moot with an avatar, you know, Christopher Poole with a picture of my face. I mean, these are all very different ways of kind of, or, you know, like, I don't know, you know, guitar enthusiast 123. Like, these are all very kind of different ways of kind of being known and interacting online. And I really want there to be a world where you can have a 4chan that's fully anonymous. You can have, you know, something in between where you have a pseudonym, and then you have something, you know, where you have Facebook. I would not call Facebook authentic identity, though. I think that's something they've called it before. I think Cheryl said that at DLD a few months ago. There's some sort of riff on, like, you know, Facebook is your kind of authentic self. And I don't think that's true. But, I mean, again, like, having a contributing as Christopher Poole, full name with a picture, like, there is a time and a place for that. It's just that is not all times and all places. And I think that's where, you know, we kind of differ, is that a Facebook person, you know, Mark, Cheryl, whoever, would argue that's how it is. You know, Facebook is kind of appropriate for all times and all places. And I would say that's not true.
There has been a lot of attention recently on Anonymous, the group, the ephemeral hacker collective, and the spin out LulzSec and the various other spin outs that have happened as the organization has splintered along ideological grounds. It's absolutely fascinating to watch as a psychologist. I'm like, wow, this is online community just in action. But Anonymous with a capital A, how that probably gets in the way of an anonymity with a small a, doesn't it? Like it does a disservice. It does what 4chan offers, the options that it offers, a disservice, doesn't it?
I wouldn't say that. I mean, it's certainly something that, I mean, it has been fascinating for me to watch as well, just how it kind of grew out of, you know, the culture, image, kind of the English image board culture, and, you know, to see how, you know, little a Anonymous went to be capital A Anonymous has been really fascinating. I don't think that they've done any disservice. I mean, certainly with, you know, something that kind of concerned me, you know, so, like, also to note, like, you know, we actually, with 4chan, you know, like, raids, invasions, all that stuff, personal information is against the rules, and so Anonymous, you know, the kind of the spark, you know, kind of caught on 4chan, and again, like, they've kind of inherited a lot of that image board culture, but it did splinter off and become its own, you know, distinct group very, very quickly, and they have their own forums and own image boards and all that, own wikis, chat rooms and whatnot, separate from 4chan and separate from other image boards. But I think you saw it very early on with the first protests against the Church of Scientology. I mean, some of them were, you know, again, like, objected to Scientology's, you know, the practices and the kind of methods the church would employ, and they would have these kind of very thoughtful arguments for why you should not be a member of the church. And then there were others who would call in bomb threats and, you know, and you know, do other kind of, like, lewd acts or, you know, swear, you know, they would harass the people entering the church. And so I think that's always been interesting, because how do you, in an anonymous organization, how do you identify those who are truly kind of committed to the cause and advancing the cause? And then how do you identify those who aren't? And then how do you isolate and kind of extricate? And that is one of the advantages. And it's like, in one sense, because it's not, you know, anybody can join in and participate, and potentially your ranks are much larger than they would be otherwise, because people, you're able to join without kind of fear of what that might mean for their home life or, you know, job life or anything like that. But at the same time, it's like, when you do have people who aren't really committed to advancing the cause and who are kind of troublemakers in a sense, how you are then able to remove those people. And that is, like, one of the advantages, like, it kind of, ironically, that an identified organization would be, if you were in a trade organization and some guy was, you know, cussing out your competitive trade organization or something, like, you know, you would boot them from your organization. You would say, look, this is not, you know, helping us. We, you know, you need to stop, or you need to leave. And so I think that's been really interesting. I mean, like, you know, you've seen the kind of similar thing with Occupy Wall Street. Again, there are a lot of people there who are really passionate about, you know, seeing change in the financial system. But then there are people who kind of also end up there as kind of these kind of hangers-on. And, you know, there, you know, what we saw in New York is, like, you know, there were just a very, very few incidents that kind of undermined, you know, some of the public opinion about, you know, what it was they were doing. So I think it is an interesting conundrum, because you can see arguments for, again, like, because it is you're kind of relatively anonymous, you don't have to, anybody can participate, but at the same time, then once you do have a troublemaker, what are you able to do about that person? So it is kind of like a conundrum that they face.
Yeah, I recently wrote my chapter about hate, and so many people think that the anonymity aspect is the contributing factor to what is then?
I think it's just people, right? People have been assholes for as long as there have been people. There is, again, like, when you do give somebody kind of a veil and you know, people would say, well, that's removing kind of the repercussions for your actions. And when people have that, then they kind of, you know, go crazy. And I mean, I would just point to, YouTube, or there are a lot of other, you know, like actually I think the thing that, so that kind of goes back to, people think that identity means accountability. They think that, you know, if you have a name and a face, you're accountable for your actions, right? And I don't think that's true at all. Like, I think that actually, if you look at 4chan, 4chan is one of the most accountable communities on the web. I mean, like, they have, there is, the community is kind of so tightly knit and has such a strong culture that in order to be a, you know, you, anybody can technically come in and contribute to 4chan, right? Like, within 5 seconds of hitting the site, you can post something if you want. But the community does such a great job at kind of moderating the number of people that, that enter their community by, you know, forcing you to understand kind of the lingo. And, you know, you have to kind of talk the talk, walk the walk to be able to participate. And if you don't and you post something, they'll really, like, force you out. They'll say, who the hell is this new guy? You know, get lost. And they're pretty brutal about that. So I feel like, you know, you could say that in a sense, like, that community is more accountable than anywhere else, because there's certain things that would fly in a you know, identified kind of a system that certainly don't fly on 4chan. And when you do have, like, you know, on YouTube, you have a persistent identity across all of your YouTube comments, and people are still, you know, terrible to one another. And on, you know, a lot of newspaper websites, like, actually the New York Post is a great example. You know, you look at any, I had a joke with a friend, like, we could, like, it was like the 6 degrees of Obamacare, where, like, any article on the New York Post ended, like, it would be like a cat stuck in a tree. And then, you know, like, 3 comments later, it would be about, like, Obamacare. And, like, somehow people would take these, like, abstract kind of things and link them to something that they hated. You know, a person they hated, or a thing or an idea, something they hated. And I was like, what? Like, and again, like, you know, these are communities with either pseudonyms or with full names, maybe not faces, but, you know, full names or first name and first initial. And so I would say that, you know, extremely common misconception that having a name and a face breeds. I mean, actually, look at Facebook trolling, which is a big problem. And people, like, certainly create fake accounts, but there are actually plenty of people who I think are, again, you know, terrible to other people on Facebook, and are comfortable using, you know, using their real account to do that. I think, again, it speaks to a people problem and not to, you know, all of a sudden, oh, well, you don't have a name and a face, so, like, you know, we've released these shackles on you, you know, go nuts.
Yeah, the research early on in psychology looking at this thing called de-individuation, which is very much about anonymity, was focused on this idea of lifting the veil, and suddenly you are disinhibited and you can do anything, and it's amazing, and people will do all that kind of stuff. But quite soon after, about a decade after, there was a whole swathe of research that looked at the cultures and said, actually, it's about the contextual cues that help to modify behavior, that help to influence behavior. And so, in fact, it isn't just the anonymity. So what you're suggesting then is, with your people problem, the web, full stop, whether you're anonymous or not anonymous, as a context in which people feel perfectly happy to flame, perfectly happy to post hideous things, perfectly happy to attack one another and bully, is that, are you saying it's the web's problem?
I think maybe in a way. I mean YouTube as a community, it's like the community of YouTube does not enforce, you know, the big kind of, like, don't be an asshole rule. Whereas, like, a community like Flickr, I mean, you know, when they built Flickr, it was very important to them that they had this kind of these policies, and that they built up this really strong, you know, core community that was able to integrate new users into their culture, which was, like, to be supportive and to critique work and to not be kind of total flamers. And when you look at your average Flickr comment, it's much better than you know, elsewhere on the web. And that's not a result of strict moderation or a strict set of rules. You know, I guarantee that your average Flickr user has not read through the terms of service, has not read through, you know, the code of conduct and whatnot. But, you know, it is this kind of, like, maybe it's like internet broken windows kind of a theory, where, like, you know, you go to Flickr and all of the comments are really insightful and helpful, and maybe some of them are critical, but critical in a positive way. Then you're let, I mean, like, you know, some people say, well, for a troll, that's, you know, that's like, I think somebody used the example a long time ago. It's like, you know, walking into a room with muddy shoes. Like, there's all that more, you get even more of a rise out of messing up something that's not messed up. But I think for most people see that. And again, they fall in line. Again, like, that community is able to integrate new users into their culture, which is to be really positive and supportive. And YouTube doesn't have that. Like, YouTube is you kind of get lost in this just free-for-all of people being jerks to one another. And so it's easy to see why, like, your average, you know, new user is just, because they go, oh, this is okay here, this is permissible, the community accepts people being jerks to one another, so I can do that too. So I think that's like a really powerful difference. And I think the other thing that people really forget is that like we go through our everyday life with relative anonymity, right? Like I don't remember faces on the street. Like just because, you know, I see somebody walking down the street doesn't mean that they're not anonymous to me. I think that's another thing that like people kind of misconstrue this idea of like name and face as, or like, oh, well, people aren't anonymous in real life. And it's like that, what? Like, do you go ask everybody their name and social security number when you pass them on the street? Like, you know, you go through life. I mean, you know, only people that you really make connections with, you know, and slowly kind of de-anonymize them. And you're right, like going to like the cues that you have. I mean, you're able to, you know, go through your day with kind of relative anonymity, but you do pick up on a lot of different kind of cues from people. I mean, you can look, I mean, everything about a person, you know, it's the way they're dressed, the way they walk, the way they talk. I mean, we've been kind of trained growing up to take, kind of feed all of these, you know, cues through a filter and then figure out how do we approach these people.
Yeah, online people would say that's the stuff that you can't see. You know, that's the thing about the web that freaks people out, isn't it?
I guess in a sense, yeah. I mean, you're coming at somebody, right? All of the things that we kind of take for granted in real life, you lose on the web when you're looking at a, you know, four-digit or, you know, four-letter username moot, right? Like people don't know what to, people only know kind of know what to expect now because I've become more public over the years. But, you know, back 8 years ago, nobody knew how to really interact with me.
But that's why the whole ASL culture comes in, because you then, if you have age or sex or location, then you know how to interact with somebody.
That's
there's
true,
a
right?
There's an issue with not really knowing how.
Those are the big cues, like right in chat rooms, you know, going back decades. It was like those were the three magic things that you needed to know, and then all of a sudden, you know, like that would give you enough almost to, like, fill in the rest of the blanks. You'd be like, oh, okay, like now, yeah, like I've kind of like primed my brain now for how I should be able to communicate with you.
I mean, the ephemerality of 4chan is, to me, the most interesting. It's not even the anonymity, but it's that combined with the ephemerality, because the idea of having an identity, even if it's a pseudonym, means that you can then create that identity, don't you? You then have the kind of the cues, and you can have the reputation, and you can say this person is trustworthy or this person is not trustworthy based upon their actions linked to a persistent identity. So that, I think, is the most interesting thing about 4chan.
Yeah, I mean it's certainly in terms of like the rise of the site too. It's not only for the kind of privacy aspect of it, but it is very much a kind of, you know, we joke about how like on B, because things are rolling off within minutes, you know, the only things that really stay on the board for more than a number of minutes are things that really resonate with the community. I mean, there are two ways. Either the thing you post is so amazing that people love it and they keep reposting it. Or you are very persistent about, like, and this is what we call a forced meme, where people are, you know, one or two individuals are really persistent, and then they kind of force it to, you know, it's like, what do you call it? It's like almost like viral marketing. But the things that really do click and really resonate, again, they appear day after day, month after month, and those are the things that are then kind of, you know, spread within the community and then are kind of carried outside of the community. I mean, that's how we get, you know, these things like lolcats and rickrolling, and you know, there are a million other, actually. Those are probably the two still biggest examples now years later. But, you know, there are thousands upon thousands of funny, you know, images and slang and phrases and stuff that have come out of the community. And it's kind of created this environment where it's like a survival of the fittest as far as ideas go. The only things that really click and are posted time and time again are able to kind of escape this kind of vortex of the site. And so I think that is rare online now, and it's part of the reason the culture is what it is.
So if you're saying that 4chan is like the final bastion of this kind of space, and, you know, we're seeing in China, the government is requiring people to register an online to offline identity. We're seeing here...
But Korea, you know, actually, that's like, you know, for as much flag as we might give China, like, you know, South Korea has been doing that forever. Like with games, when you have signed up for an MMO, you put in your equivalent of like your, I mean, it's your South Korean national ID. So it's funny, just like, I mean, like we like to jump on, like, you know, if Iran or China start doing these things, we're like, ah, you know, they're so evil. But like there are other, you know, first world, you know, friends of democracy that have been doing this for some time now.
And so if we've got these authoritarian or government or democratic or whatever, these decrees from the top down, in these countries, saying you need to connect your online and your offline identity with something that is like a national identity number. And then in the US and the UK, we are doing it voluntarily through things like Facebook and connecting existing networks. How do you see yourself and 4chan persisting as this single battered site in the sea of de-anonymization in the next 5 years?
I mean, I think it's really important to separate kind of what I refer to as kind of like the front end versus the back end. You know, like 4chan provides front end anonymity, right? I mean, 4chan is not something like Tor. You know, Tor allows you to, you know, route your internet traffic through multiple different nodes, and it kind of anonymizes your internet traffic. And so you appear to a website as kind of, you know, anonymous, more or less anonymous, or, you know, disconnected from your, you know, if I'm browsing from New York, it'll make it look like I'm browsing from London. So that's kind of like more on the, like, that's the back end kind of anonymity. And what 4chan provides is this front end where it's, you know, you have relative anonymity to other users on the service, but you don't have any anonymity to somebody like me. I mean, like, that's the, like, the fact is, like, you know, we've recorded IP addresses. We don't save them indefinitely, but, you know, like, that's the way, like, our software works is, like, you know, we do use it for rate limiting and for banning, you know, bad users. And, like, you know, so we've had IP addresses for active postings for the longest time now. And so, and so in that sense too, like in the US, I mean, you know, you don't have, I mean, like, maybe you're not linking it to your national ID, like maybe in South Korea or, say, you know, soon China, but, you know, your IP address, you know, your ISP obviously, you know, knows, you know, which customers have, you know, what IP address at what time, and you know, when served with, you know, legal process, then they tell that. So you essentially do have, like, an implicit kind of ID on the back end in America and in any other country. I mean, Germany is actually even arguably, I mean, yeah, I guess you could call it maybe worse about this, where, you know, they have some, like, the really, like, really stringent, you know, laws dealing with how long ISPs need to keep records. In fact, I think it was proposed, I think it was Germany, or maybe it was the EU recently, where somebody proposed, like, keeping... you know, like, detailed, or maybe it was a, like, Scandinavian country, but it was, like, there was some country in the EU that proposed basically just keeping a record of all, not the traffic itself, not the content, but basically a history of all connections. So you could go back, you know, for, like, days time and be able to say, like, oh, such and such happened, we can see that this and that. And to make it, like, compulsory for ISPs and for service providers, like websites, to keep these really detailed records for, you know, a number of days. So again, like, you know, maybe that's not the same as having your, you know, equivalent of a national ID or social security number linked to your Facebook profile, but it really is. Again, like, on the back end, there is this kind of implicit link between, you know, the service provider, you know, that you're using and your real identity.
So there is a limit to anonymity.
There is. And I think, again, it exists mostly. I mean, like, if you really wanted to truly be anonymous, you'd have to use a combination of something like 4chan and Tor. Or something like online, I guess, you know, they call it kind of the you know, deep web, or, you know, like, Tor has these ways of creating websites that exist only as nodes within the Tor network. That it's, you know, as long as they're kind of set up correctly, it's more or less impossible to find out, you know, where, say, they're hosted.
That's a heck of a lot of technical knowledge. I can't really see my mother doing that.
No, absolutely not. I mean, like, Tor is one of a number of these kind of you know, services that have kind of cropped up over the past decade that you know, provide that. So, you know, for the average person, I mean, that is, you know, the internet is kind of centralized, right? And there's, you know, there's Aaron and ICANN and you know, between the two, like, more or less, you know, that's, like, there's the root servers, there's the, you know, the you know, DNS, or, you know, I mean, root servers for DNS and you know, people, the actual registrars themselves. Like, there are very few. You know, the internet is controlled by a kind of a few organizations, and so I think that's what's, like, more scary with, like, the SOPA stuff that you've seen in the U.S. and the kind of different cyber blacklists and whatnot, the proposals in the, I think, EU and Germany and Australia. You know, now for governments or organizations to be able to you know, lobby to kind of, you know, essentially just take a website offline or to make it very hard to access for users, that I think is very scary.
One final question. What would we lose if we lost anonymity online? Like, even with things like Tor and 4chan, what would we lose if we all had to be identified?
I think just a fundamental part of being human. You know, it's to have relative anonymity in within a group, or total anonymity, are things that, you know, we used to cherish going back, you know, hundreds and thousands of years. So you know, people haven't changed that dramatically, you know, over that time. So I think it's kind of a fallacy to think that all of a sudden, given kind of like the technological advances of just the past 5 to 10 years, that all of a sudden we can kind of take just part of like the human condition just to throw it out the door in the name of, you know, advertising revenue.
You've been listening to a special episode of Tech Weekly from The Guardian. I'm Alex Kratosky. And based on the pieces of data that I've been able to accumulate, I've come to the opinion that the person producing this program is Jason Phipps. Find out more at guardian.co.uk/techweekly.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace. With World Cup fever taking over, we at The Guardian are pretty sure that you're thinking big too. So maybe now is the time to use Squarespace to create your own professional website for your small business, portfolio, or blog. It's easy. You could create your own site during halftime. Just go to squarespace.com to start your free trial. And to support this podcast, use the offer code Guardian to get 10% off.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.